Welcome to Catholic Answers Live, the program where you participate with your questions about apologetics and evangelization, including the most important theological, spiritual, moral, and social issues facing the world today. Call now with your question for today's guest, toll-free 1-888-31-TRUTH. That's 888-318-7884. Now, from San Diego, Catholic Answers Live.
Hello and welcome. Cy Kellett, your host here with you, and it is open forum today on Catholic Answers Live, even though we had the day off yesterday for the Holy Day of Obligation, and it feels like a Monday to me. It is, in fact, Thursday, and Thursday means open forum. Open forum means any question that you have about us Catholics, what we believe, what we do. What our history is. 888-318-7884 is the number if you want to know about Catholics' understanding of the sacraments or of the moral life or what the Pope is up to, the Bible. It is open forum, 888-318-7884, our number. Our guest this hour, Jimmy Akin, senior apologist here at Catholic Answers and the author of A Daily Defense, 365 Days Plus One to Becoming a Better Apologist, and the most recent 20 Answers book, Bible Prophecy. Hi, Jimmy.
Howdy. How you doing?
I am very, very well. And did you know they have a deal on this? I did.
I heard about it in email this morning.
Oh, yeah. So if anyone who bought – we'll talk a little bit more about it later. But if you buy A Daily Defense at Catholic shop.catholic.com, you get the Bible Prophecy book for free.
Yeah.
And everything's 20% off in addition to that. I haven't done this in a while.
Mm-hmm.
Digitus Dei.
What?
You know what? Digitus Dei? I'll use my finger to find
a day?
A day. Yeah, a question.
Okay, so you're hybridizing English and Latin there. Digitus from English and from Latin, and then Dei from English. Because otherwise, if they were both in Latin, it would mean finger of God. Because in Latin, like, it would be, I'm trying to decline DS in my head. But I'm too uncaffeinated, so never mind.
Are you better at Latin the more caffeine you have?
I'm better at many things the more caffeine I have.
Well, I picked out day 159, and it's the year Jesus was born. And by the way, it's 365 days, but they're not connected to calendar days. You can start the book any day you want and go through for a year, or you can just thumb through. It's a fun book in that way.
You can binge read. Yeah.
You can binge read, right. So our calendars – this is the challenge, and then Jimmy will give the defense. Our calendars are mistaken. Jesus wasn't born in 1 BC, but around 7 or 6 BC.
Yeah. So the first response is, so what? I mean, even if this claim were true, then what does a mistake in the calendars have to do with the faith? I mean, the church does not teach as a matter of doctrine that Christ was born in any particular year. It teaches he was born, but it doesn't teach that it had to be in some particular year. And the calendar year is something that is basically a matter of convenience. And actually, for centuries, we didn't have the current way of reckoning years. In Jesus' own day, it was common to reckon years either by the reign of some ruler, like, say, this something or other year of Augustus.
Yeah.
You know, he reigned for a long time. And so you could date things by how long Augustus or some other leader had been reigning. Also, because people in the ancient world were crazy huge sports fans like they are today, it was common to date things based on what Olympiad you were living in, because the Olympics were held every 4 years in Greece. And so you could say, like, this is the third year of the 134th Olympiad as a way of dating the year.
Uh-huh.
And then also in Rome in particular, there was a longstanding way of dating things from the founding of the city. And so that's – you sometimes see that the Latin abbreviation for that is AUC. And so if you're sometimes looking at a document, you see a number followed by AUC. It's that many years since the mythical founding of Rome. And so in terms of the in terms of our calendar, it's not a point of faith that Jesus was born in a particular year. We get our numbering system for years from the work of a monk named Dionysius Exiguus, or Dennis the Short. And what he did was he calculated how many Easters it had been since the time of Jesus, because Easter was a big, you know, celebration in the church's calendar, and they, in order to determine when Easter would fall, they needed to do a bunch of calculations every year, and so they would make these Easter tables. And he used some prior work that dated things back to the reign of the Emperor Domitian. But Domitian was a bad guy who persecuted Christians, and so he thought, well, let's not date things based on Domitian. Let's see what we can do to base things on Christ.
Uh-huh.
And so he ended up proposing the date of one, what's now called 1 BC, and there is no zero year. There's no zero AD BC. It jumps directly from 1 BC to 1 AD. And that was his proposal, but it's not something the church teaches as a matter of faith, so big deal. Also, you'll even find like statements like Pope Benedict talking in at Christmas time about how Christ actually was not born in 1 BC and so forth. The claim that he was born in 6 or 7 BC is one that is very commonly proposed today, but it looks like that answer is not correct. And we can go into why when we take our first call, because by pure coincidence, I can see the first call deals with this.
And now we're talking Digitus Dei. Yeah. So Dionysius
Exiguus.
And was he roughly a contemporary of Dionysius Menasiguus?
I don't know who Dionysius Menasiguus is.
Oh, Dennis the Menace. That's just the Latin form of Dennis the Menace.
he lived about 1,400 years earlier.
Oh, he did. Okay. All right, because that's my favorite, Dionysius. Daniel in Benton, Missouri, listening on 89.1 FM. You are on with Jimmy Akin. Your question, please.
Hello, gentlemen. Thank you for taking my call.
Happy to.
Excuse me. Yeah, it is coincidental because what you guys were just talking about is precisely dating is the nature of my question. Concerning specifically the census of Quirinius, there in Luke 2:2, it reads, "Now in those days a decree went out from Caesar Augustus that a census was to be taken in all the inhabited earth." This was the first census taken while Quirinius was governor of Syria.
Mm-hmm.
Josephus posits that the actual census was around 6 AD.
Who did you say? It sounded like you said Cephas.
The Jewish historian Josephus.
Oh, Josephus. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Or Josephus. Yeah, I may not be pronouncing that right.
Either way, I just misheard.
In 6 AD, but if Luke is correct in his dating, this would be more closer to somewhere around 10 or 4, rather, 4 BC.
Mm-hmm.
So I just wanted to see if you could perhaps speak to this historical discrepancy and, I guess, give an answer.
Yeah, sure. So there are a bunch of answers here. The first thing to note is that Josephus doesn't actually say this census, the one that Luke is talking about, occurred in 6 AD. I would be overjoyed if he did. I would love it if he did say that, because that would mean that he had the Gospel of Luke in front of him and thus that the Gospel of Luke had an early date. But he doesn't say that. He reports that the governor Quirinius, who was for a time governor of Syria, that he took a census in 6 AD, and Josephus mentions that there was a census at that time, but he doesn't say that it's the one that Luke was talking about. That's a connection that has been proposed by various scholars, because the 6 AD, the 86 census was a big famous one that people knew about. So put a pin in that for just a second, and I want to talk about a couple of other things connected to this text. First one, I'm not sure what Bible you're reading from, Daniel, but it's not unusual in that it translates the word that Luke uses in Greek as census. A bunch of Bibles do that. But really what the word means in Greek is enrollment. And so it's a more general term. There's some kind of enrollment that is under discussion, but it's not clear that it was specifically a census. And in particular, it's not clear that it's what was known as a tax census, which is – it's often understood to be that this was a tax census like the one that Quirinius did in 86. It could have been some other kind of enrollment. Now, the logic – and I'll cover this really quickly – but the logic that says Jesus was born in 6 or 7 B.C. goes like this. Herod the Great died in 4 B.C., and the Gospels record Jesus was born during the reign of Herod the Great, and Matthew indicates that the wise men came up to 2 years after he was born. So that would mean Jesus would need to have been born at least a couple of years before Herod the Great's death, and so that would put Jesus' birth in 6 or 7 B.C., a decade before the Quirinius census that was so famous. There are problems with this. The first one is the dating of Herod's death in 4 B.C. is wrong. It does not appear that Herod died in 4 B.C. That's a view that has been popular among scholars, but it's also been really convincingly answered by scholars such as Jack Finnegan and Andrew Steinman, both of who are experts in biblical chronology. It appears instead that Jesus was born in Herod died in 1 B.C. and that Jesus was born a year or two before that, so in 2 B.C. or 3 B.C. And then guess what? The date of 2 or 3 B.C. corresponds to the 42nd year of the reign of Augustus. And according to the consensus of the church fathers, because they weren't using our calendar, they said Jesus was born in the 42nd year of Augustus. And it's not just one father. It's a bunch of them. And so the testimony of the church fathers seems to agree with more recent scholarship that indicates Jesus was born in 2 or 3 B.C. Now, were there any events of an enrollment nature that happened in 2 or 3 B.C. and applied to the entire world? Well, guess what? The Roman Emperor Augustus was named father of the country by the Roman Senate, and according to an inscription that Augustus himself wrote, the entire Roman people all over the world consented to that. And it appears that there was in 2 or 3 BC this public testimony or acknowledgement to Augustus as being the father of the Roman people. And Josephus records that there were about 6,000 Pharisees who refused to do this, but everybody else did. And so it's possible that that's the enrollment that's being talked about. On the other hand, there's another possibility, which I'll mention just briefly, and this is a very common understanding. When Luke says that – and there are others besides that I won't have time to mention – but when Luke says that this was the first census – of Quirinius, the word translated first can also be translated before. And so what a lot of scholars have proposed is that Luke is saying this was before the famous census of Quirinius in AD 6 that everybody knew about. So he's actually trying to avoid people misunderstanding when Jesus was born, because actually in Luke's gospel, Luke also gives other clues that point to Jesus being born in 2 or 3 BC. But that's another story.
Daniel, we have to take a break. Thank you very, very much for that call. It is open forum today on Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy Akin is our guest. 888-31-TRUTH is our number, and we'll be right back with more after this.
Call and ask Jimmy your question today on Catholic Answers Live.
Just like the saints of the Counter-Reformation, our own souls are in constant need of reform, of reconversion to God and His will for us. We struggle with sin. We become distracted in prayer. We find it hard to be loving and easy to be selfish. In Reform Yourself, Sean McAfee shows you how these magnificent saints can be guides to your own personal transformation. We all need to reform our souls. Let the saints who reformed the church show you how. Order your copy of Reform Yourself today by calling 1-888-291-8000, visiting the shop at Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Pope Francis said, "The key that opens the door to the faith is prayer." Join St. Paul Street Evangelization by running a prayer station in the public square. You don't need to be a professional apologist or theologian. Just listen to the needs of the people you encounter. Offer encouragement, take prayer requests, and pray with people. Find out more and get involved today at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
For All Souls Day today, the Church's lectionary gives 12 gospel options for Mass, because the gospel is mainly about our death and the eternal life Jesus gives us. Some Christians focus on one or two passages, like Romans 10:8. If you confess with your lips that Jesus is Lord and believe in your heart that God raised him from the dead, then you will be saved. True, but salvation demands more. For example, John 3:5, unless a man is born of water and the Spirit, he cannot enter the kingdom of God. Baptism is necessary for salvation. And in Matthew 7:21, it is not those who say, Lord, Lord, who will enter the kingdom of heaven, but the one who does the will of my Father. And the most comforting, John 6:54, anyone who eats my flesh and drinks my blood has eternal life, and I shall raise him up on the last day. May our beloved departed rest in peace. I'm Father Vincent Serpa for Catholic Answers, Catholic.com.
Call now with your question, 888-318-7884. This is Catholic Answers Live.
Open forum today on Catholic Answers Live. Any question you have about the life, the faith, the history of the Catholic Church is welcome. Jimmy Akin is our guest, senior apologist here at Catholic Answers. And we go now to Peter in North St. Paul, Minnesota, listening on the iHeartRadio app. Peter, your question for Jimmy Akin.
Hi, guys. It's a big honor, Jimmy, to talk to you.
The honor is all mine.
So I have a question about Fatima, and I have to admit that I don't know much about it. But the question comes from an argument group in the Twin Cities. It's really great, and it's for Catholic men. And they had a guy come in, and he gave a instead of an argument, he just gave a kind of lecture on Fatima, and it seemed very conspiratorial, to be honest. He said, first of all, that it wasn't private revelation because it happened so publicly, and that seemed confusing to me. But then also, he claimed that the Church is hiding a bunch of stuff about the Third Secret and that Russia's never been consecrated. And I just wanted to know your thoughts on the issue.
Okay. So number one, Fatima is what the Church refers to as private revelation. Private doesn't mean that nobody is aware of it or that there can't be like miraculous demonstrations that are obvious to onlookers, like the miracle of the sun. When the Church refers to something as being private revelation, that means it's not part of the body of revelation that was given to the Church as a whole at the beginning when Jesus gave the apostles the deposit of faith. So it's something that applies only to certain people in the Church. Obviously, for one, people who are living after the time this new revelation was given. It also doesn't have the same level of authority as the public revelation that Christ gave us in the beginning. And that's something the Catechism talks about in its section where it discusses private revelation. It acknowledges that the revelation that Jesus gave us was definitive and that we can't accept any new revelations that claim to supplement or correct the revelation that Jesus gave us. That revelation is what He willed the Church as a whole to use as universally authoritative until the Second Coming. And of course, at the Second Coming, when He comes back, new mysteries about God will become apparent when we see God face to face. But until that time, nothing is on the same level as the public revelation that Jesus gave us through the apostles. So it is private revelation, and by saying it's not, the gentleman who gave this lecture is off using terminology in his own idiosyncratic way and in a way that's going to confuse and perplex people, as obviously it did in this case. In terms of the claim that the Vatican is suppressing information, this is flatly not true. Pope Benedict has indicated that it's all been published. Cardinal, I'm blanking on the name, was originally the second in command at the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith, later
Bertone?
Secretary of State, Cardinal Bertone, who is also involved in the release of the Third Secret. Thank you, Cy. Has also indicated that the whole thing has been published. They've said this multiple times, and if you say that this is not the case, then you're basically saying that those men, including the saintly Pope Benedict XVI, are liars, and there is no way around that, because Benedict XVI, as Cardinal Ratzinger, was the man tasked with keeping the third secret. And so it was in the archive at the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith. He read it at John Paul II's initiative. He was one who participated in its publication. And if you trust these guys, there's simply no room for saying that they suppressed any of it. So you got to make your choice. But to me, I'm going with Pope Benedict and not with this particular school of conspiracy thought. Not that all schools of conspiracy thought are wrong. There are real conspiracies in the world, but this is not one of them. In terms of – there was a third bit to your question, Peter. What was that again?
I can't remember, but they're –
Oh, the consecration of Russia. It was yes, the consecration of Russia. So John Paul II attempted a consecration and basically got word back from Sister Lucia, who was still alive at the time, that it hadn't met the conditions named by Our Lady. He then did another consecration and afterwards consulted Sister Lucia, and she reported that the consecration had been done and had been accepted in heaven by Our Lady. So that's not church teaching. But it is the understanding that the principal players, including Sister Lucia herself, had, and I don't have adequate grounds for arguing against it. And I think you're going to disturb a lot of people's faith if you do argue against it. I think part of the reason that people sometimes go in this direction of thinking the consecration wasn't done is they then say, well, Russia hasn't been converted. And they're having an unrealistic interpretation of what the conversion of Russia means. Because if you go back to the original Fatima revelations in context, they involve, among other things, but they involve Russia, they involve World War I and World War II, which hadn't broken out yet. And they talk about how Russia is going to spread its errors throughout the world, which it then did because in 1917, while World War I was still going on, you had the Russian Revolution and the communists came to power and began exporting communism throughout the world. And so that's the context for Russia will be converted. It means it's going to stop spreading communist errors throughout the world. And guess what? It did. After the consecration of Russia and the rest of the world in the 1980s, Russia fell apart in 1989 and ceased to be communist, and it thus stopped exporting communist errors. It was converted.
Peter, how does all that strike you?
As always, Jimmy, that was fantastic. I don't want to take up too much more of your time, but I had a quick question. He also claimed that Cardinal Burke is of the opinion now that the consecration wasn't valid. Have you heard this?
I've heard information about that, and I would be unable to explain. If that's something Cardinal Burke holds, it's his personal opinion. But since I'm not in heaven, I don't have access to God's opinion. I'm dependent on the opinion of what's been revealed, and what's been revealed is that Sister Lucia, the visionary in the case, said that it had been accepted, and so and that it had been done, and so I would hesitate to put any private opinion of a different person up against what the seer herself said.
Peter, thank you very, very much for those questions. It is open forum today on Catholic Answers Live. You got any philosophical questions for Jimmy, too? He's usually pretty strong on those as well. But if you want to know about the Catholic faith, what we believe, what
caffeine.
We do. After caffeine. Okay. Give us a call, 888-318-7884. We'll be right back with more after this on Catholic Answers Live.
We're ready and waiting for your call today on Catholic Answers Live.
We need Catholic radio because we need the voice of the church in the public forum. We live in a time that the secular voice dominates so thoroughly that we need to get that Catholic perspective out. Just as Fulton Sheen used radio and TV in the last century, we need to continue to use. This means to announce the Catholic faith in the public forum.
Bishop Robert Barron thinks Catholic radio is important. So should you.
This is apologist Tim Staples, and I'm here to tell you about the most exciting and innovative Catholic book in years. In today's world, people from countless perspectives pose challenges to our Catholic faith every day. In conversations, through the mass media, on the internet, and more on the infinite collection of social media platforms. There's no getting away from this daily onslaught. We as Catholics need to stand strong to be prepared to mount a daily defense, to respond to the many challenges that we as believers are presented with every day. To that end, my good friend and apologist extraordinaire Jimmy Akin has come up with what will surely be a go-to resource for years to come, a daily defense. A daily defense takes up a different challenge for every day of the year, 366 in all, teaching you how you can defend the faith and give answers to Catholics and skeptics alike. And it's user-friendly, with challenges and answers indexed alphabetically by scripture verses or by topic, so finding the answers can be quick and easy. Order your copy of A Daily Defense today by calling 1-888-291-8000, visiting Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. As we mentioned earlier, when you purchase a copy of Jimmy's book, A Daily Defense, in our online shop, we're going to add a copy of his brand new book, 20 Answers Bible Prophecy, to your order absolutely free. And the order itself will be 20% off as long as you put in the promo code WINTER, because it is our winter sale right now. And so all purchases, whether of MP3s, videos, everything else we got there, books, it's all 20% off when you put in the promo code WINTER. Just go to shop.catholic.com. Now, this Jimmy Akin deal is a limited time offer, so
right.
Take advantage of that quickly. You just purchase A Daily Defense for 20% off, and you get the brand new Bible prophecy book from Jimmy Akin absolutely free.
I like your laid-back delivery. It's because you could do it with, you know, the AM announcer voice, like, order now for a limited time and you'll get Jimmy Akin's book, A Daily Defense. But that's not all. You'll also get a free copy of his 20 Answers Bible Prophecy. And if you act now and use the promo code WINTER at checkout, you'll get 20% off these and everything else in our online store.
We just need to have an arrangement that has three easy payments. That was good, Jimmy.
Thank you.
AM radio voice,
but
yeah.
With the 20% discount, you don't need three easy payments. Just one will be easy.
Yeah, right. One easy payment for Jimmy Akin's book. Just go to shop.catholic.com. 888-31-TRUTH is our number, and we are talking about anything you want to talk about having to do with the Catholic faith or having to do with philosophy, morality, all those things at which Jimmy excels. We go now to John in Las Vegas, Nevada, listening on 970 AM. John, your question for Jimmy Akin.
Yeah, I had a question about what is the earliest historical evidence that we have for Eucharistic adoration? Not merely, a tabernacle as a place for the repose, but actual, the adoration of the Blessed Sacrament.
Well, they're two different things. Because you can have Eucharistic adoration and did have Eucharistic adoration long before the invention of tabernacles. You had Eucharistic adoration effectively from the Last Supper going forward. because people recognized this is the body and blood of Jesus. He's really there, and because he's the Son of God, we need to adore him. And so you had Eucharistic adoration starting right there at the Last Supper, and going forward, we see references in St. Paul indicating that he took it so seriously that profaning the Eucharist could lead to people dying. You had at the beginning of the second century St. Ignatius of Antioch talking about how certain heretics refused to acknowledge the Eucharist as the body and blood of Christ, indicating that Orthodox Christians did. And so from that, it naturally follows, if you realize Jesus is there, then you're going to have Thomas's reaction of saying, my Lord and my God, and adoring him. So tabernacles are a much later invention, but Eucharistic adoration has been with the church from the very beginning.
As a Catholic, I certainly agree with what you're saying, but I think that a lot of non-Catholics would say, some that acknowledge some type of real presence and don't believe in adoration, they wouldn't the idea that it follows wouldn't be as compelling as, for example, one of the church fathers not merely recognizing the divine presence, but actually.
Let me address that concern. I think you may be using the term adoration to refer to something different than what I am. The term adoration, I'm using the term adoration without further qualification, where a person adores God. That's something that even our non-Catholics who acknowledge the real presence, including Orthodox and Lutherans and Anglicans and other people who all acknowledge the real presence of Christ, even if they may think there's some bread there or it's unclear whether there's bread there, if they acknowledge that Jesus is really there, then they will adore him. And so they have Eucharistic adoration in that sense as well. Now, one of the things that is common to some of these views, including Lutheranism, is the idea that Jesus is only present when the sacrament is in use, and that the real presence ceases after the celebration of the liturgy, after you consume the Eucharist, whichever comes first. So they will say the real presence ceases at a certain point, and so for that reason, they don't have adoration outside of the context of their liturgies. That's in the Protestant community. The Orthodox communion is a little different. But in the case of various Protestant communities that believe in the real presence, they typically think the real presence only happens when the sacrament is being celebrated and then ceases. And so they will say that, yeah, we adore Christ in the Eucharist, but then he ceases to be in the Eucharist. That's not the Catholic understanding, however. The Catholic understanding is that once the consecration happens, the real presence remains as long as the appearances still appear to look like bread and wine. And so the real presence remains even after the celebration of the sacrament has concluded. And that's why it's possible for Catholics to reserve the Eucharist and then also have Eucharistic adoration outside of the liturgy. And that's something that we have evidence for very early on, because Christians would in the early centuries have authorization at times, because they couldn't always get to church because of the persecutions and so forth. One of the things that sometimes would happen is lay people would be authorized to take the Eucharist home after it had been consecrated by a priest and keep it in a secure place and adore it at home before consuming it, let's say on a Sunday when they couldn't get to church. And so we have records of that happening very early on in church history, and that testifies to the Catholic understanding of the enduring nature of the real presence that makes extra liturgical Eucharistic adoration possible, as well as Eucharistic reservation. One final note, don't take the Eucharist home today. It is not allowed.
John, thank you very, very much for that call. We do appreciate it. Hope that was helpful to you. We go now to Angel in Anaheim, California, watching on Facebook. Thanks for joining us on Facebook. Angel, your question for Jimmy Akin.
Hi, good afternoon. My question for Jimmy is, if someone dies defending the faith or defending the truth and, you know, obviously becomes a martyr, do they go straight into heaven, or would there be something like, if they have mortal sin, would that not let them go into heaven?
Okay. So let's deal with the mortal sin question first. If somebody is in a state of mortal sin at the time they die, they do not go to heaven, period. It does not matter what they were doing at the time they died. If they're in a state of mortal sin and don't have God's grace in their soul because they've turned their back on God and said, I don't want to be with you in eternity, God is going to respect that choice. Even if they may appear to be defending the faith or dying a martyr's death. Having said that, if it is quite possible that a person who is defending the faith or dying a martyr's death, even if they were in mortal sin, will cease to be in mortal sin. Because if they realize their life is on the line and they're choosing to accept death for purposes of defending the faith or defending God or however you may want to phrase it, it is very likely that that act of itself is one that will cause them, that contains the repentance needed to be reconciled with God, and thus they will cease to be in a state of mortal sin. They'll re-enter a state of grace and thus die a legitimate martyr's death and go to heaven. So the way the question is phrased, if they literally die in mortal sin, no, they're not going to go to heaven. But even the attempt to die a martyr's death, or the willingness to accept death for the sake of the faith, is likely to contain within it an act of repentance that can reconcile you with God so you don't leave this life in mortal sin. In terms of what then happens, there is an opinion out there that I've heard some people express that if you die a martyr's death, you're going to go straight to heaven. You're not going to need to get cleaned up in purgatory because of the sufferings that you experience as a martyr. That's possible, but it's not church teaching. And so I'm unaware of any place that the church teaches that that's the case. So as far as I know, it's still possible that you may need some cleanup in purgatory even after your martyr's death. But there is an opinion that the sufferings of a martyr will make up for whatever purgation you needed. I just don't personally know whether that's guaranteed to always make up for all of the purgation you need.
Angel, have to say thank you because we have to take a break. It is Open Forum today on Catholic Answers Live. This hour we have Jimmy Akin, senior apologist here at Catholic Answers, as our guest. Next hour, Mark Brumley, president of Ignatius Press, will be here. So if we are not able to get to your call by the top of this hour, hang on. Mark will be here to take your calls next hour. Our number, 888-318-7884. We'll be right back with more Catholic Answers right after this.
Catholic Answers Live with Jimmy Akin is coming right back.
I met my husband in my first year of college. We both came from strong Catholic families and wanted lots of children. After 3 years of marriage and still not pregnant, we felt our dream of a big family slipping away. My sister encouraged us to visit our local Catholic store and get a novena to St. Gerard. When we arrived, we were unsure about our need, but the staff was kind and helpful. Wow, what an incredible Catholic store. They encouraged us to pray and trust in God's providence. One worker told us stories of other couples, just like us, who were desperate to start a family. 4 years and 2 children later, we have been back to that incredible Catholic store for baby, baptism, and toddler gifts. God bless the staff at that incredible Catholic store. An incredible Catholic store in your area can be found at incrediblecatholicstore.com. The Incredible Catholic Store, transforming the world one soul at a time.
Did the Catholic Church add books to the Bible, or did Protestants remove 7 books from the Old Testament? In Why Catholic Bibles Are Bigger, author Gary Machuda takes you on a fact-filled tour through the history of the Bible, revealing the whole story behind the lost books of the Protestant Old Testament. With the latest information, discourse on crucial issues, and a topical index, Why Catholic Bibles Are Bigger is a book that belongs in the library of every serious student of Scripture. Order your copy of Why Catholic Catholic Bibles are bigger today by calling 1-888-291-8000, visiting the shop at Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Call now with your question, 888-318-7884. This is Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy Akin is our guest, and as we said earlier, there's a deal on Jimmy's book, A Daily Defense, at shop.catholic.com, but we'll give you Jimmy for free. We will give you a...
You keep saying that, and I keep telling you the 13th Amendment doesn't permit that.
I keep forgetting to look up the 13th Amendment, but no, I know what the 13th Amendment is. but we'll give you a fantastic talk that Jimmy gave at our national conference just a little over a month ago, just a few days beyond a month ago, on the... Oh, gosh, you're going to have to help me.
What the Reformation was all about.
What the Reformation was all about. And I forgot the title. And how do you get that for free? Well, you go to catholic.com/radio club and you sign up for the radio club. And then we send you this MP3 for free. And then what happens after that is you get the radio. You're part of the radio club, which has secret benefits I don't want to talk about. No, it probably doesn't. They're all public benefits. And among them, we send you our radio club newsletter. We try to make that snappy and helpful to you. And occasionally, maybe every 2 or 3 months or so, there'll be another free MP3 from one of our apologists or someone else of great interest. So give that a try. Would you please just go to catholic.com/radio club and become a radio club member today? It's all free stuff, and we don't bombard you with emails or anything like that. You don't have to worry about that. It is open forum. We go now to John in Falls Church, Virginia, listening on 1160 AM Guadalupe Radio. John, your question for Jimmy Akin.
Hi. So we've been talking about some early church history and themes. So I guess continuing that, would you be able to speak to the development from the consiliarity in the early church as like the means of like I guess developing doctrine versus I guess this development towards I guess the Church of Rome and the Pope as the more I guess papal supremacy versus papal primacy, I think is what they tend to call it.
Who tends to call it those things?
So it's like a Orthodox perspective, I guess,
okay,
versus a Catholic perspective on the role of the papacy in the early church.
Okay. From a Catholic perspective, you know, the Pope is – and Orthodox agree with this part, that the Pope is the successor of Peter. And the question is, what kind of authority does the Pope have? You have a claim that's often made in Orthodox circles that Peter was the first among equals, or primus inter pares, to use the Latin, and that meant that the Pope didn't have the kind of substantive authority that Catholics attribute to him. Well, okay, it's a claim that can be examined. So what can be said in defense of it? Well, it's certainly true that there was a time in church history where, because of the diffusion of Christians throughout the world, and because the infrastructure of the Christian church hadn't developed to the point that everybody could be in frequent contact with Rome, that oftentimes churches were kind of left on their own for extended periods of time, and so their bishops had to undertake, you know, a lot of initiatives without any ability to consult Rome or without any direction from Rome. But there was still, even in this period, a recognition that Rome had a special authority because it had the successor of Peter there. And so this era was – and the relative independence that you see in this era is due in significant measure to the growth of the Christian faith, without a corresponding growth that took a while to catch up, of the strength of the infrastructure of the church, allowing frequent communication with Rome. And so because, you know, it's very hard when everybody's underground and being persecuted by the authorities, it's very hard to have frequent consultations with the Pope, especially if your bishop is in hiding and the Pope may be in hiding and lots of people are in hiding, and it just kind of gums up the works. So persecution has a tendency to do that. So we can't really look at this early age as an indication of what Christ's will for the church is. For that, we need to look back at the founding of the special role of Peter by Jesus. And when we do that, we see something different than the first among equals model. The first among equals is something that the alleged first doesn't really have substantive authority over other people, is something you get in systems like the Supreme Court, where the Chief Justice doesn't really have authority over the other justices, but he does have a certain dignity and gets to make a couple of different kinds of decisions. Like if he's in the majority, he gets to assign a case, assign the writing of a decision to someone else in the majority. But that's a kind of structural thing. It's not really a substantive authority. The thing is, in the ancient world, they didn't have that kind of stuff. Nobody thought in those terms. And so the idea of a first among equals really would not have been intelligible to people in the first century. If God gave you authority, he gave you authority. He didn't just give you some extra dignity that other people didn't have, but that you did. So the apostles would have understood, and Peter would have understood, Jesus to have given him substantive authority. That's reinforced when we look at the fact that Jesus then gives Peter a special pastoral mission relative to the other apostles, telling Peter to strengthen their faith and feed his sheep, depicting the other apostles as sheep that are under Peter's care. So that analogizes the shepherd is not just the first among the sheep. He's in charge of the sheep. And he may have to work collegially with the sheep because they're a big flock that can stray. But there is a difference in kind between Peter and the other apostles, the same way there's a difference in kind between the shepherd and the sheep. Also, when you look in Matthew 16, Jesus uniquely gives Peter the keys of the kingdom. He never shares that with the other apostles, and he uses the singular to tell Peter he's given him the keys. I give them to you in the singular. And the background for that is in the book of Isaiah. It's mentioned in the book of Isaiah, but it's the fact that there was a chief steward of the house of David who ran the household on behalf of David, and the key was a symbol of his office. We see it being transferred from one person to another in Isaiah. This office is known from other sources as well, though. But by using the symbol of the key of the kingdom in connection with Peter, Jesus, as the son of David, is appointing Peter the chief steward of the house of the new David, and that means that he has a unique authority among the new David's servants, the same way the master of the palace had a unique authority among the other servants of the original King David and his successors. So all of that was right there in the beginning, in the founding of the papacy with Jesus, but then it's manifested in different ways over the course of the centuries, as illustrated, for example, by the fact that the age of persecution put impediments in the way of it being effectively exercised for a few centuries, and it wasn't until afterwards that that the Pope was able to perform his function without having the weight of persecutions hampering things.
John, thank you very much. Lots and lots of callers, so I'm going to keep moving. Thank you for that call. We'll go now to Kimberly in Laguna Hills, listening on 1000 AM Relevant Radio. Kimberly, your question for Jimmy Akin.
Hello. Thank you so much for taking my call. My question is regarding the order of the Mass, the mm-hmm. liturgical order. When we have the consecration and we know that the real presence is then with us, my question is the peace be with you afterwards. Mm-hmm. Some say that it might take the reverence off Christ being there and focused on another. So I was wondering why they put the peace be with you after such an important part of the Mass, not saying that the peace be with you isn't important.
Right. So this is a question that phrased a little differently, various people have wondered about. Technically speaking, the name of what you're referring to is called the Sign of Peace. And actually, it's exchanged, properly speaking, it's exchanged between the priest who's celebrating and the congregation when the priest says, peace be with you, and everybody responds. Then, and that doesn't really take the focus away from Jesus. I mean, the priest has been acting on behalf of Jesus throughout the Mass, acting in persona Christi. But then an option that was added to the liturgy after Vatican II lets the deacon or the priest or even somebody else say, let us exchange the sign of peace. And then there's an individual exchange of peace with other people in the congregation. And that's a custom that originates in some Eastern Rite Catholic liturgies. They have a variation of that, for example, in the Maronite liturgy. And after the Second Vatican Council, it was decided, hey, that's a pretty neat custom. Let's include that as well. And they put it there presumably to – because Jesus says, don't go to your sacrifice if you haven't reconciled with your brother. And so it can make sense to put it right there before the communion rite. It's like we're all making sure we're reconciled with each other before we go receive communion. And so that's presumably the logic for why it's there. But various people have noted, while it doesn't take any reverence away from Jesus, we can still do this reverently. It is a bit of a distraction. And so various people have thought maybe it should be at the very beginning of Mass instead. And people have – some parishes have a kind of greeting custom at that point in the Mass anyway. Maybe that's where this should go. And there was a discussion of that back in 2005 at the liturgy – at the Synod on the Eucharist, that it be moved in the liturgy, and the newly elected Pope Benedict – had the Congregation for Divine Worship begin a study of that. And based on his own writings, it would seem that he himself might be inclined to move it. But nothing ever came of that. And so apparently whatever study they did, it didn't arrive at a strong conclusion or didn't arrive at, in any event, at the conclusion that it definitely needed to be moved. And so it subsequently hasn't been moved.
Okay. That helps me quite a bit. Thank you so much.
No problem.
Thank you very, very much, Kimberly. 888-31-TRUTH is our number here at Catholic Answers Live. It is open forum today, and we have time for another call. So let's do that as quickly as we can. If you can, Mary, in Heartland, Michigan, can you state your question as quickly as you can for Jimmy?
Really, basically, I just wanted to know how the Pope ended up being in Rome,
mm-hmm.
Because I don't understand. Peter was the first Pope, right?
Yep.
How did the present-day Pope and his predecessors end up being in Rome?
Okay. Well, originally, so Peter lived in different places in his life. After Acts 12... he ended up having to flee Jerusalem because there was an attempt on his life by King Herod, and so not Herod the Great, another Herod, and so he fled and ended up as Bishop of Rome, and therefore that's where he left his successor.
Thank you very, very much for that call. Again, Open Forum will continue next hour with Mark Brumley, president of Ignatius Press, here to take your calls. Jimmy Akin, thanks very much for a very nice, entertaining, and informative hour.
Likewise. Thank you, Cy Kellett.
It's always a pleasure. 888-318-7884 is the number. Don't forget, Jimmy's book, A Daily Defense, is 20% off, along with everything else at shop.catholic.com. But right now, you get Bible Prophecy, his latest book, for free when you order that book. We'll be right back with more Catholic Answers Live, Open Forum, after this.